We can trace this element right through the Bible. Like Adam and Eve. What was the problem? They couldn't handle the radicalism. The garden is wonderful. The Garden of Eden. They put in paradise, as it's called. The Garden of Eden. Beautiful garden. Everything you want, you can have. Everything is there. But of the tree, of this tree in the garden, you shall not eat. Oh, that's offensive. Every requirement, every demand is a challenge to our inner being. That is why radicalism is so repulsive to us. Friendship, yes. Obedience, no. All our kids here know that, eh? Parents always telling us, blow your nose, comb your hair, wash your face, eat this, eat that, finish this. You see, you are facing radical demand all the time. The teaching of the gospel is summed up in this very thing. A great German theologian wrote a book with this title, Radical Obedience, to sum up the teaching of the Lord Jesus in just those words. It is radical obedience. Another American theologian has recently written a book called Radical Commitment. In our church, we use the same similar word called total commitment. Because only total commitment is the adequate answer to total demand. That is the thing we must grasp. But it is offensive to us, to our nature. Why is it offensive? Because we feel our sovereignty threatened. We love this word sovereignty, isn't it? Sovereignty. Oh, lovely. I am sovereign. I am master of my life. And here comes a command which threatens. And it is very sad how deep this problem goes. Let me share with you something that is very painful to my heart and has mystified me, puzzled me to this day. And it's not easy for me to talk about it, but I want to try to use this to illustrate this point to you. And it has to do with my relationship with my dear father. And even this morning, I was pondering and puzzling over this matter and thinking whether I should share this with you or not to try to illustrate. How deep is the problem, the challenge that we feel whenever our sovereignty is brought into question by some competition or some command? You know, my father and I had a very unique relationship. I think perhaps most parents and children have never enjoyed such a relationship. We talked together, we played together, we enjoyed each other's company, though for a very short time, because he was a very busy man. He was the call of government. He was quite a high government official in China. And the duties of government, of course, kept him very busy. But whenever he could, we really enjoyed being together, walking together, chatting together, as friend with friend. I often forgot that he was my father. He probably forgot I was his son. We just played together, enjoyed each other. We argued together, but in a friendly way. And we played chess together. Yeah? Chinese chess, of course. Which I didn't lose in 3 moves. Sometimes I won, sometimes he won. At least we had long struggles over chess matches sometimes. And he used to joke with me too. He used to say, when he lost the game, he would say, yeah, he reminded me that another governor used to play with his son. And every time the son won, he would say to his son, the only thing you are good for is playing chess. But if his son lost, he would say to his son, you can't even play chess. So whether he won or lost, it's not much good. We had really good times together. He taught me to box when I was quite small. He was a good boxer. And we used to teach me how to punch and combination punches and things. We had good times together. I seldom managed to land a good punch on him. But if I did, he was a good sport. He accepted that very graciously. I thought it was very nice of him. Of course, I was the one who got most of the punches. So it was a great relief when I could occasionally manage to land a good one on him. Of course, we did Western boxing with quite well-padded gloves so that we didn't do much injury to each other. But we enjoyed that. We enjoyed good times together. We talked about the future, did many things. And my father was very dear to me. I also respected him greatly. A man of tremendous integrity, honesty, a very good man. A man of principles who taught me to love righteousness, to love truth. And although there was so much corruption in the government in China, as all of you must know, he stood up against the corruption. He did not fear the opposition. He did not fear the opposition of powerful men, not even the opposition of the, some of you who know Chinese history, recent history, know the Si Da Jia Zhu, the four powerful families, Kong and so Kong Jia and others. The four families who controlled so much of the finances that were related to the president and so on. He was a man of principle. His life was often in danger. And he was a deadly shot with his gun, too. He was his own best bodyguard. He didn't trust bodyguards. Because, as you know, in a corrupt country, you can buy the bodyguards. The bodyguards could be the very person to kill you. And that's what happened to Mrs. Gandhi, as you know, in India. She was shot by her own bodyguard. No, he didn't trust the bodyguards. He carried his own gun, and he was a deadly shot with that gun. He trained me to use the gun, too, because there was danger of kidnapping, and that is... So he would take me to the underground training chambers to target practice and so on. We had great times together. Great times. We even worked out the plan of defense, I remember, which was very interesting. That because of the confusion with the communist takeover, we even looked at the house together and studied how we would fight from room to room if we were attacked by bandits or mostly soldiers who had gone astray, and then I would hold this position, then he would run to that room, he would fire from that position, and I would rush to the next point and fire from that position. Wow, it was real commando operation, this one. But we had wonderful times together, because these are the things that bound our hearts together. We depended on each other. We trusted one another. But as I grew older, something strange happened to this friendship. And this is what puzzled me. And I've tried to understand it all through the years, and I still don't understand. But today, when talking about radicalism, I'm beginning to see a little bit of the reason for this. As I grew older, the friendship grew colder. It became harder and harder to communicate. At that time, I attributed to the tensions that he had to face with the collapse of the nationalist government. But then gradually I began to realize the problem was much, much deeper than that. And one day, and I didn't see it at the time, but later as I thought about it and I put it together, one day he mentioned to me that he had seen a fortune teller. Now, we weren't Christians. I wasn't a Christian at the time. He was a sort of a nominal Christian. I wasn't a Christian at all. And it didn't strike me as strange at that time that a Christian goes to see a fortune teller. Christians don't see fortune tellers. That is contrary to the teaching of the Bible. It's strictly forbidden. But I didn't know that since I was not a Christian. It's only later as I thought about it, it's strange. How come my dad went to see a fortune teller? And he saw two or three very famous fortune tellers in Shanghai. People whose words were so solid that it could be written down and looked at later on. You know, most fortune tellers are not there to write down what they predict. You can say it never came to pass. It's rubbish you wrote here. But these kind of fortunes dare to write down what they predicted. And one day in a conversation, it slipped out of him, I think somewhat accidentally, that the fortune teller had said to him, "Your son." And he said, "What about my son?" I'm the only son in the family. No brothers and no sisters. Lone ranger. But your son is going to be a great man, greater than you. That is something you must never say to my father. That anybody is going to be greater than him would be dreadful. Not even his son should be greater. Maybe almost equal, eh? But greater. And you know the sad thing about it? The sad thing about it is that he took it seriously. At the time it slipped out of him, I took it as a joke. I mean, I don't believe in fortune tellers. I don't care who they are, know how famous they are, or write whatever they write down. I'm not interested in any of this rubbish. But he took it very seriously. And you know what happened? The relationship between us was destroyed through the fortune teller. Much to my sadness, I always loved my father. I couldn't understand why he became colder and colder. Why? Because he believed the fortune teller, he saw in me a threat to himself, a threat to his sovereignty and to his superiority. He saw in me, according to the fortune teller, a rival, and he became afraid of me. He, with all his ability, his tremendous intelligence, with two doctor's degrees behind his name, PhD, Lit D. Why was he afraid of me? I wasn't even interested in his field. But he knew I had military ambitions in my non-Christian days. Was that the reason he was afraid? Since he was in politics and I would be in the army, if I ever got to the army, I might be a threat to him. Who knows, I might do a takeover and he would be in charge of the government, I'd take over. Maybe he was imagining something of this kind. But the strangest thing is, even after I became a Christian and gave up all my military ambitions, no more ambitions, he still stayed away from me. I can't understand this. It cuts me to my heart like a knife. My father, whom I love, why don't you talk to me? Why don't you want to see me? What did I do to you? When did I ever do anything wrong to you? And so this morning I was meditating and thinking, I have a little taste of what God feels towards us. God is saying, I want to be your friend. And we come up with all kinds of ideas. You really want to be my friend? I'm suspicious about this. I mean, you are God, you're so great. You surely don't want my friendship. If you want my friendship, there must be some ulterior motive. Something fishy behind that. So what is God going to do? So we stay away from him. Oh, you see, you want my friendship, huh? But you say I have to obey you in everything. What kind of friendship is this? I knew it was something fishy going on here. Didn't you have that feeling in the Bible study when they said, you are my friend if you do whatsoever I command? Fishy. And I think my father thought, as he looked at the things I was doing, he was putting all this interpretation on things I was doing. I mentioned that he taught me to box, and I became a fairly good boxer. I went on to further training in boxing. By that time, he didn't want to fight with me, of course. But then he was puzzled that I also went into judo. And it seemed that he put all kinds of interpretations. Why is boxing not enough? Why do you want to go into judo? Well, you see, I was a non-Christian in those days, and I like to do things very thoroughly. So I looked at boxing, Western boxing. I knew it was a good and effective way of defense. You remember Muhammad Ali challenged anybody to fight him. If they thought that karate or anything was superior to Western boxing, he says, you take me on. I will fight the best karate fighter there is. Western boxing against karate. You remember that part? Very interesting. He said he would go to Japan and fight anybody in Japan to prove that his skills are as good as any of the best they got. But as I thought about boxing, I saw there was a weakness. So I tried to cover all the angles. And that's, I think, what worried my father. I always tried to do one thing more, to outdo. And he thought, in this case, I was trying to outdo him. You see, he knew only boxing. Now I would do boxing and judo. The reason, I never thought about him, of course, I never thought of fighting with my father. I mean, so what is he worried about? Maybe one day I could protect him better, you know, if he gets outnumbered. No, I saw the weakness of boxing was that boxing is a distance fighting. That means, like karate, you have to stand back to fight. But if you tangle with a wrestler, you're finished. For example, if you're walking down the street and a good fighter jumps you from the back and grabs hold of you, you can't punch him because he can't hit him. You have to stand back to get an effective punch. But if you are close in, if he got you by the neck, if he got a bear hug on you, what are you going to do? You haven't got enough range to give an effective punch. So I tried to cover the deficiency of boxing by going into judo, which is a contact wrestling, fighting, which means you hold on, you know how to deal with somebody who holds on to you, whether from behind or in front or wherever. So I had no motive of competing with my father at all. It was not even in my mind. But my father got suspicious. You see, he's always trying to go one step ahead of me. He's always trying to outdo me. So only later, when I thought about it, I began to see, why does he feel threatened by his own son? I have not the least intention to threaten him. I think in many ways he's superior to me. And I'm very happy about that. I'm happy that he's superior. I don't see him as a competition at all. The subjects he studied, I didn't study, so I would not compete with him in his field. He was an economist. His doctorate was in economics. Later on, when I became a Christian and I went into studies, I went into different subjects. I specialized in philosophy and literature, for example, of the Far East. It was a different subject. I couldn't compete with him in that area. And different from him is when I was offered the chance to do the doctorate in London, I declined. I was not interested in the doctorate. I wanted to go and study theology, so I turned down this chance to do the PhD. So he should have felt quite comfortable that he has two doctorates, I have none. I'm not competing with him. But he still feels threatened. I still don't understand this. What more can I do? I'm not in the same field. I don't go for the same attainments. Why are you threatened? And the saddest thing, which I think I mentioned to some co-workers at one time, which was almost the final blow to my heart, was when my mother was ill and suffering from tuberculosis, I would go and visit her from time to time in Switzerland. And one year I took out time to go and visit my mother, going from England to Switzerland. My father came from Portugal, where he was finishing a book that he was writing. And you know, when he heard from my mother I was arriving the next day, he left the day before so that he wouldn't see me. I tell you, it was like a knife to my heart. And when I arrived to see my mother said to me, you know, your father left yesterday because he heard you are coming today. Couldn't take it. Could you take that? Could you stand there? So what have I ever done wrong to my father? What did I do? When he was in Portugal doing his research project, I wrote to him and said, Dad, can I come to see you? So we can talk face to face. If there's any misunderstanding, let's sort it out. Can I come to see you, please? At my own expense. You know, I went through my studies without my father's financial support. I didn't get support from him. And when he later on, almost towards the end, offered my support, I felt it was very hard for me to take it by then. I said, can I come and talk to you? No, the answer was no. He didn't want to talk to me. I began to understand God's heart. He wants to be our friends. He wants to talk to us. He said, what wrong have I done to you? And yet we blame him for this and that. Why did you create a world full of sin? And now I'm a sinner because of that. It's all your fault. Now you accuse me of being a sinner, but I didn't make the world. You made the world. You made a world full of sin and all these nasty people around me. And now you blame me for being like them. We find 1,001 reasons for de-radicalizing. You have no right to ask me to obey you completely. Because so much of the problems are because of you, not because of me. And now you even want to make a radical demand on me. That I can only be your friend if I obey you completely. We cannot see that it is for our own good because we don't know the way we are going. Suppose you are lost in the jungle in Malaysia. And you don't know where you are. Here you look and there's a big python coming down. There you saw some gorilla going around with like M16 or whatever they carry down there. Whew, very dangerous. You know, which way to go? In danger all around. And suddenly somebody comes along who is an expert. He knows the jungle like the palm of his hand. He said, you want me to take you out? No, yes, please. You want me to be your guide? Yes, please. Then you have to do exactly as I tell you what to do. Whew, what kind of a guide is this? What kind of guide? Now you're in total demand on me. Everything. He says, if I say don't cough, you don't cough. Don't blow your nose, you don't blow your nose. If I say jump, you jump. If I say drop flat on the ground, you drop flat on the ground. This guy is unreasonable. I mean, all right, you want to do me a kindness, you want to be my guide, that's fine, that's nice, all right? But don't take it too far. I've got some dignity left, you know? If he says, if I tell you rub mud on your face, you rub mud on your face. What is this? Of course, we don't realize. I mean, you saw soldiers put black dirt on their face, right? Well, this is for their protection, camouflage, right? So if he tells you to do something, you may not understand why he tells you to do it, but he tells you to do it for your own good. But we don't have that confidence in God, do we? We don't have the confidence that every command he gives us is for our good. We don't have that confidence. That is the reason why we resent it. We think that our sovereignty is being threatened by his commands. But if the guide doesn't do that, if he tells you to drop flat right away, you don't obey his command, you might be shot dead. You see, we've got to understand that the commands are not for God's good. It's not because he is so bored, he has nothing to do in heaven, that he enjoys shouting commands to you. It's the commands. Every command is to save us. It's for our good. If you can only understand this, the commands are the concrete expression of his love and his friendship. The only way he's going to get us out of this mess is if we obey every command absolutely, radically, no compromise. If he says, drop, you drop. Every soldier understands that. But we don't understand why God makes this kind of demands on us. We find it offensive. We complain. We murmur. So many commands. Love one another. Look at this guy. Who wants to love him? You get me some decent fellow, then I love. And the kind of people who wants to love. Love each other. Love everybody. Be reasonable. There are one or two people you say, love this one, I can love. Everybody. You've got to be a little discriminating. We've got to choose our friends. That's what the world teaches us. But God says, everyone. Because that's what I do. Oh, the radical nature is so offensive. Some people have said that the sect, what distinguishes a religious sect from the orthodox position is radicalism. If that's the case, then what we have got in the teaching of Jesus and the teaching of Paul and the whole Bible is sect. Love God with all your being. The truth of the matter is that's not true. The sects are not radical. They, like all other people, have de-radicalized the gospel. Sin is de-radicalization or contra-radicalization. There are two words we have to remember. Try to remember three words. Radicalization, de-radicalization, contra-radicalization. That's all in the Bible passage that you studied in Revelation chapter 3 on the Laodicean church. It's all there. To be hot is radical. To be cold is contra-radical. The opposite of being hot. To be lukewarm is to be de-radical. It's going from hot to cold, coming down. And all through the history of the church, we have de-radicalization or contra-radicalization. The sects that we have today, look at their teaching. The Seventh-day Adventists tell us you should keep the Sabbath day. They want to take us back into the Old Testament under the law. They have de-radicalized the cross. You are now saved partially by the cross and partially by keeping the Sabbath day, the Seventh-day Adventism. You look at any of the other teachings, they're all de-radicalized. The radical element has come out of them. There is no truth in the statement. And there is contra-radicalization. I read in the newspaper just the other day. In fact, yesterday, Seremban, this is a Malaysian paper, Seremban, I don't even know quite where it is, but is about this girl, who took weed poison, killed herself. The tragedy of it is a very radical solution. Suicide is a radical solution to a problem. But the tragedy is that when she was examined, it was found that she had a baby, 6 months old, in her stomach. Her radical solution to her problem, and we don't have to go into her problem, the radical solution was to kill both herself and her baby. Well, if she wants to kill herself, at least let the baby be born, right? First, and then kill herself. But she went and went and killed both of them at the same time. That means there are two kinds of radicalism. God's radicalism and man's radicalism. And there's in the sects a certain kind of human radicalism. We must distinguish between these. And these man's radicalism is what constitutes what I've called contra-radicalism. It is the rejection of God's right over my life, and I can do with my life what I want, including kill myself, kill my baby, kill my husband, kill my parents, which they've been doing in North America, as you know, kill everybody. And in the end, go out with your gun and shoot everybody in McDonald's, throw hand grenades, shoot everybody in sight. I got a bit worried the other day in Australia. In Melbourne, there was some guy going around shooting everybody. Every car that went by, he just shut them down, and then the next car came and he shut them down. All the cars piled up, the people were killed. What for? He doesn't even know these people. And I got worried because we have co-workers in Melbourne, and we got brothers and sisters in Melbourne. I was hoping that none of our people got shot by some fellow who went around killing everybody. It is simply sheer madness and rebellion. That is contra-radicalism. Man's radicalism is opposite to God's radicalism. Our time is gone. We have to close. Are you prepared for friendship with God? Are you willing to submit unconditionally, without feeling threatened in yourself, without withdrawing from God, without being afraid of God's love as suffocating you, as seizing you? Let me say quite simply as we close. Unless you say, Lord, I accept your radicalism. I accept your sovereignty. I accept your kingship unconditionally. If you ask me to drop dead, I drop dead. But he won't ask you to do that. That's the word. If you ask me to do this, I will do it. And then you know what? Instead of feeling bound by that radicalism, for the first time you enjoy true freedom. That's the mystery. He that humbles himself, the scripture says, I will exalt. When you try to obey him absolutely, he makes a king out of you. He will put you over the angels. We are called to reign with him. That's what you read in Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 2. He wants to make us priests and kings. The Lord Jesus is the example of that. He humbled himself to the lowest position. He obeyed absolutely. He submitted absolutely to the radicalism of his Father. And what do we read in Philippians chapter 2? That God raised him up highest over all. He gave him a name above every name. It is only when we obey absolutely that we have absolute freedom. When we obey absolutely, we will enjoy friendship with God. Can you take this message? No. Oh, yes. That is your decision. But if you try to water down this message, if you try to resist or reject or minimize God's sovereignty over your life and my life, you will find you will never have friendship with God. Why does God have so few friends? I hope you understand the answer to that question now. We always feel threatened by God's total demand, by His radical demand, because we don't understand that it is a demand of radical love, absolute, self-giving, unconditional love.